as we continue the second hour, and certainly this information about Lost Again, a warning by Henry Lamb, is right on the money. And you can see the Law of the Sea Convention on the website, AmericanExpose.com. It's up there. It's there for you to see. And it's most important for you to view. Most important. From Jan Lemprecht, AfricanCrisis.org, he states that Mandela was in London recently, that's Nelson Mandela, looking decidedly Russian in his dress. There he was, the most famous man in the world, begging the rich countries for $50 billion in aid to Africa. Jan Lemprecht is in South Africa, and here in South Africa, he says much was made of the fact that the USA refused to write off Africa's debt in the crazy way that socialist Tony Blair wishes. But then, stepped the Lord thy God, Nelson Mandela, and of course, America immediately saw the goodness of life, or so it was repeated here. In his book, Government by Deception, available on Amazon.com, Jan Lemprecht stated quite clearly that in his opinion, this is a tactic aimed at getting other countries and businesses to do the work of Karl Marx himself. He pointed out how in South Africa, Saint Mandela runs around begging for money from Microsoft and any other company he can get to. Of course, Jan Lemprecht says, I must not whine too much about this money these blacks run around the world begging for, because it is all coming here. However, being honest, I merely wish to inform people overseas that this money is all going to be wasted. I've said this many times, and the historical facts are there to prove it. You can write off the debt of Africa this time, and in a few years, you can write off the whole debt again and again a few years later. And I'm telling you about people up front, that 10 years or more, Africa will be poorer than it is now, even if the world's caught up with the $50 billion in the write-off of debt, which Mandela wants. And he says, mark my words, you people have been warned by whites who live here and who have seen how your well-intentioned gifts are stolen, misused, and generally wasted. And even if it goes where it should, the black Africans are such that within a few years, they will ruin whatever it was that was built with the money. All across Africa, from north to south, east to west, stand failed foreign aid projects. It is the only continent that has gone backwards since being decolonized, and I'm willing to bet that no continent has ever had as much aid as Africa. The good intentions of foreign governments are many. The extent of which foreign nations will grow to help blacks is amazing, and yet much of it comes to naught. How many times have you seen UN and other programs to teach blacks to farm, for example, yet Africa is producing less and less of the food it needs? Sometimes the extent of foreign aid is staggering. I have a friend in Botswana who used to do consulting work for a bank there. He told me how the German government suddenly decided that this bank needed some new computer system, and hey presto, the Germans give the money for free to this bank to have this computer system written for. My friend told me that these things go on all the time. Western governments are constantly trying to help blacks here and there, and they put up the hard cash. They look for all manner of excellent projects, and yet, despite all these things being done, these countries often move forward, at best, at a snail's pace. And the minute the aid stops, the countries fall back into a ruin. Nothing ever lasts. This is rather extensive, and a little more. It looks to me as if people outside Africa will have to waste money, or waste many, many billions more, before they learn the lessons that Africa is a bottomless pit. Apparently, tens of billions of dollars of stolen donor money lie in Swiss bank accounts. I once read that African leaders have enough money in their Swiss bank accounts to pay off one-third of Africa's debt, but you will never see them offer to pay as much as 1 cent. People have yet to learn that you give an inch and Africans will take a mile. In fact, they will demand several miles. This is extremely long, and I don't really have the time to get into this, but you can certainly see where his mindset is, and I can relate to certain thoughts that he has, being directed at us and on us. Let's go to this article and see where it covers. It's entitled IMF Looked at Gold Sale Options for Debt Relief by Andrew Balls, Chris Giles, and someone else's name that I can't even bother to pronounce, dated February 6th. It states the International Monetary Fund is preparing a report on the potential sale of a portion of its gold reserves, any move that would help fund debt relief for poor countries, but could unsettle the markets by threatening a drop in the price of gold. Finance ministers from the Group of Seven countries meeting in London at the weekend asked Rodrigo Rato, you've heard of me talk about him before, IMF Managing Director, to make proposals to the fund's shareholders at its April meeting. The IMF values its store of 3,217 tons of gold at about $8.5 billion, about a fifth of the market value. Poor countries owe about $11 billion to the IMF. If the IMF sold large quantities of gold, it could finance the debt owed by its poor countries. An alternative option is to be studied would be to revalue the gold in the IMF's accounts. This would strengthen its balance sheet, against which it could then write off lending to poor countries. But this is seen as an accounting gimmick that would do nothing to free up real resources within the fund. Gordon Brown, UK Chancellor, who has long supported making better use of the IMF's gold, said the greed move, or the agreed move, was an important step towards debt relief for the poor countries following a G7 meeting that focused on development aid and on Africa. Gold-producing countries sensitive to its price have traditionally opposed sales by the IMF or by central banks. But Trevor Manuel, South Africa's finance minister, told reporters that South Africa would not necessarily oppose sales as long as the process was carefully managed. Opposition to gold sales still exists within the G7, however. John Taylor, U.S. Secretary, Under Secretary for International Affairs, said the U.S. was, quote, not convinced that gold sales is a necessary way to do debt relief, end quote. Canada also opposed gold sales. Ralph Goodall, finance minister, said Canada would instead be prepared to fund its share of the poor country's debt. An IMF official who declined to be named said the fund would not make recommendations on the use of its gold for debt relief, but present the pros and cons of various options. Quote, this is the kind of thing the G7 has to find a consensus on, and it is a political decision that will require the backing of all of the IMF shareholders, end quote, said the insider. U.S. skepticism in part reflects concerns that gold sales would require congressional approval. This might be tricky at a time when the administration is attempting to squeeze domestic programs. The White House will unveil its budget for 2006 fiscal year today, the official start of negotiations with Congress. The G7 communique repeated its statement on currencies, calling for, quote, more flexibility in exchange rates, end quote, where this was lacking notably in China. China was a guest at the meeting. Zhao Jingchan, central bank governor, said the renminbi was not substantially overvalued and China would follow its own timetable for moving to a more flexible regime rather than being rushed by the G7. And the source of this information is newsft.com. That's http://news.ft.com. Somewhat very, very interesting. Well, let's go to a new direction here at this stage. Where do we go from here? Oh, yeah, let's cover this, mainly because it's probably not being covered by anyone else. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that's the UNFCCC, and they talk about Kyoto enters into force on 16 February 2005. There are 8 days to entry into force. Oh, yes. 8 days into entry into force. 8 days. What does that mean to us? There are going to be many celebrations that I cover tonight or this afternoon on Melody's broadcast. The Discount Gold and Silver Trading Hour. Her number is 800-375-4188. To deal with your documented direction for gold and silver. And we're talking about Australia. They have a participation meeting and a celebration about the Kyoto Protocol. Some 8 years after its inception, the Kyoto Protocol will finally enter into force on 16 February. The NSW Premier's Greenhouse Advisory Panel will host a cocktail reception on this significant occasion. It will start with a welcome by Martin Wilder, Interim Chair, NSW Greenhouse Advisory Panel and partner, Baker and McKenzie. The comments by leading players in the global carbon market. Oh, amazing. Anyway, I just go down this. Brussels, Belgium is going to have a celebration. More Brussels, Belgium, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, Rio de Janeiro. There's a UN building in Rio de Janeiro. Did you know that? Yes, they have their own UN building. Much going on in Canada to celebrate the Kyoto Protocol. Vancouver as well, Toronto as well, Whitehorse as well. My gosh, there's much celebration going on in Canada. I'm sure Canada is pretty well disarmed, just like Australia is very well disarmed, aren't they? Bonn, Germany, they're disarmed in Germany. They're having a Kyoto Protocol celebration. New Delhi, India, they're having a Kyoto Protocol celebration, and they're more than likely disarmed as well. Indonesia, Bogor. Oh, many countries are celebrating the Kyoto Protocol. This is not a good thing. Because they're claiming that industrialization has destroyed the planet. That's a bold-faced lie. This afternoon I covered it's a warmer world, but does that mean Armageddon? And it states that when bears wake early from hibernation, Australia suffers its worst drought in 100 years, and multiple hurricanes hammer Florida. Should we believe the end is nigh? That's the nub of a debate over the human impact on global warming, which pits scientists who say such anomalies are signs of impending doom against those who say they are evidence that the Earth's climate has been chaotic. I mean, those signs of warming, for instance, Algeria had its worst snow in 50 years last month. This month, 141 countries will attempt the best effort to arrest a forecasted continued rise of global temperatures by bringing into force the Kyoto Protocol. And there's more to this, but you get the picture. You see what's going on. You see what's being generated and implemented. More UN command and control structure. That's what it's all about. That's what's being generated. Addison Honest. On the website AmericanExpose.com, under that statement that I've covered over and over again ad nauseum from the World Heritage Treaty, 17 December 1975, as I typed it out verbatim and sent it to Bill, And that's one of the projects Bill put together on the website. The World Heritage Treaty, 17 December 1975, Article 11, Section 4, where it states the committee shall establish, keep up to date, and publish whenever circumstances shall require, under the title, quote, List of World Heritage in Danger, end quote, a list of the property appearing in the World Heritage for the conservation of which major operations are necessary and for which assistance has been requested under this convention. This list shall contain an estimate of the cost of such operations. The list may include only such property forming part of the cultural and natural heritage as is threatened by serious and specific dangers, such as the threat of disappearance caused by accelerated deterioration, large-scale public or private projects, or rapid urban or tourist development projects, destruction caused by changes in the use or ownership of the land, major alterations due to unknown causes, abandonment for any reason whatsoever, the outbreak or the threat of an armed conflict, calamities and cataclysms, serious fires, earthquakes, landslides, volcanic eruptions, changes in water level, floods and tidal waves. The committee may at any time, in case of urgent need, make a new entry in the list of World Heritage in Danger and publicize such entry immediately. Well, we just had this tsunami. It was a tidal wave. What are they going to do? They're going to create sustainable communities. They're going to have no human habitat zones. We have the map up there now, finally, that correlates to that statement. The simulated reserve and biosphere reserve, the simulated reserve and corridor system to protect biodiversity, as mandated by the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Wildlands Project, UN and U.S. Man in the Biosphere Program, and various UN-U.S. Heritage Programs and NAFTA. See, NAFTA is a big player in Agenda 21. And you learn about core reserves and corridors where there will be little or no human use. You learn about buffer zones, which are highly regulated for use. And there are a few normal use zones of cooperation. You learn about Border 21 and La Paz sidebar agreement of NAFTA, 124-mile wide international zone of cooperation, which is actually 150 miles on this side of the border now by executive order. This map is vitally important to connect the dots to what's being developed. And this map was constructed from core, buffer, and corridor area perimeters from the Wildlands Project by Dr. Michael Kaufman. We have it up on the site now, finally. And it's only because so few people are doing so much that it took so long to do this. And that's the problem. That is a major problem. You learn about the Global Fire Monitoring Center. You learn about the Convention on Biological Diversity. You can go right to it now on the website. You can learn about the Rewilding Project. That's right there on the website. AmericanExpose.com. The Global Fire Monitoring Center is basically all-encompassing, monitoring every fire in the world. Why would they be doing that? To move communities or populations to sustainable communities. That's what it's all about. That's what's being done and driven and directed. In the meantime, we have the Framework Convention Alliance for Tobacco Control from the UN system. This briefing sets out to answer as straightforward as way as possible some of the questions most frequently asked about the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control by interested parties such as non-governmental organizations, decision makers, and journalists. And they ask, what is the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control? How could the FCTC further international tobacco control? What is the timetable for the FCTC? Will the FCTC be legally binding and enforceable? Why do we need an international treaty on tobacco control? How will the FCTC affect the economies of the countries which are heavily dependent on growing tobacco? it's all here. It's all in three pages. And so we have the FCTC, Framework Convention for Tobacco Control, is a legally binding treaty which was negotiated by the 192 member states of the World Health Organization, the world's first public health treaty. The FCTC contains a host of measures designed to reduce the devastating health and economic impacts of tobacco. The final agreement, reached in May 2003, after nearly 4 years of negotiations, provides the basic tools for countries to enact comprehensive tobacco control legislation. Key provisions in the treaty encourage countries to enact comprehensive bans on tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship, obligate the placement of rotating health warnings on tobacco packaging that cover at least 30% of the principal display areas that can be included, or that can include pictures or pictograms. It goes on. It's up on the website American Exposé, the Framework Convention Alliance for Tobacco Control. Oh, boy. So we go back to the Law of the Sea Convention and the Law of the Sea Treaty. It's on the website, AmericanExpose.com, towards the top. United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea was opened for signature at Montego Bay, Jamaica, on 10 December 1982. What happened on 10 December 1948? The Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What happened on 10 December 1998? Implementation of human rights treaties by Executive Order 13107, signed by President Clinton, mandating government agencies implement human rights treaties. Everything has significance. Everything is amazing. It blew me away watching the Super Bowl, watching the soldiers from the Second World War being honored during halftime. I believe it was halftime. And the proud wearers of the Congressional Medal of Honor showing up. Showing off their five-pointed pentagram, their upside-down five-pointed star, Lucifer's symbol. That's just the way it is. That's the Congressional Medal of Honor, listeners. It's on the website, AmericanExpose.com. So back to this, it entered into force 12 years later on 16 November 1994. We're talking about the Law of the Sea. Entered into force 12 years later on 16 November 1994. What happens on 16 November 2005? The Kyoto Protocol. A subsequent agreement relating to the implementation of Part 11 of the convention was adopted on 28 July 1994 and entered into force on 28 July 1996. This agreement and Part 11 of the convention are to be interpreted and applied together as a single document. The origins of the convention date from 1 November 1967, when Ambassador Arvid Prado of Malta addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations and called for, quote, an effective international regime over the seabed and the ocean floor beyond a clearly defined national jurisdiction, end quote. This led to the convening in 1973 of the Third United Nations Conference on the Law of the Sea, which after 9 years of negotiation adopted the convention. It's there on the website, AmericanExpose.com. Very important to connect these dots, listeners. There's much to this, but I don't want to elaborate on it too much more. Too much other stuff going on. Here we see the UN International Law Commission Convention on the Law of the Non-Navigational Uses of International Water Courses, 1997. Parties to the present convention, conscious of the importance of international water courses and the non-navigational uses thereof, and in many regions of the world. Oh, boy. Having in mind Article 13, Paragraph 1A of the Charter of the United Nations, which provides that the General Assembly shall initiate, study, and make recommendations for the purpose of encouraging the progressive development of international law and its codification. In other words, bringing them all together, just like what Condoleezza Rice was talking about today, trying to mend the fences with France. Whether she had any success or not, I doubt it. Many countries are getting wise to the setup in place, but they'll be dealt with eventually. That's why I have this here. Dated November 28, 2004. Top general warns Iran not to underestimate U.S. military. A top U.S. commander is warning Iran and others against thinking they can exploit the U.S. military because its ground troops are fighting two major wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is by Dennis Cook of the Associated Press, this information. Quote, why the Iranians would want to move against us in an overt manner that would cause us to use our air and naval power against them would be beyond me, end quote, said Army General John Azevedo. I guess it would be John Azevedo or Azad. The head of the U.S. Central Command said in an interview on the way to his headquarters here from Afghanistan. Some members of Congress, including Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan and Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona, have expressed concern that there is a shortage of U.S. troops and such a scenario might tempt reactions such as Iran and North Korea to increase terrorist activity to develop weapons of mass destruction. Well, the draft will be coming into place. That will be happening very, very shortly. And that is the way it is. Everybody gets on board. Everybody works together. Everybody makes a difference. Everybody exposes Agenda 21. What kind of chance do we have then? It's your responsibility as well.